Welcome back to another episode of RMV.
Hey everyone, I hope you're all having an amazing day and thanks for tuning in for today's episode. We have Dr. Tara here with us once again. Hi, Dr. Tara.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're so excited to have you back. Dr. Tara is a child and adolescent therapist, a parent coach, a podcast host, an author, and a public speaker. We're so happy and excited to talk to you.
I'll say I appreciate you having me back for the second time.
Of course. Yeah, and your episode has the top number of plays. Right now it's like almost 700. It's like right at 650. So yeah, everyone loved this episode so much. And last episode, we talked about relationship with our phone, public speaking, sleep, and much more. And in this episode, we'll be talking more about other topics regarding mental health.
Yeah, so first of all, we wanted to talk about anxiety. And according to Google, anxiety is a feeling of worry, nervousness, or unease, typically about an imminent event, something with uncertain outcome. Dr. Tara, can you further explain about anxiety and why it's so common in teenagers?
Right. I mean, anxiety is that persistent and uncontrollable worry. And a lot of times teens will experience it as dread or apprehension. And it feels like it's triggered by a specific stressful event. So somebody might say, well, I'm anxious because I'm applying to colleges, or I'm waiting to hear about my SAT score, or, you know, I broke up with my boyfriend or girlfriend. But in reality, sometimes anxiety doesn't have a straight line from an event to, you know, what your, how your brain is responding. So it's important for teens to recognize that sometimes we're genetically predisposed to anxiety. It can very much be a brain-based chemical imbalance. And if we have a stressful event and those feelings of anxiousness and worry are not passing, and we can't determine why, or even if we have some suspicions, but the anxiety we're feeling is just overwhelming, then that can be an indication that that person is suffering from anxiety, and it's like a clinical degree.
Oh, okay. And is there like a test we can take to see if we have anxiety?
Well, there isn't a test like a blood test, but when we as professionals diagnose anxiety, we're really interviewing the client. And if it's a child or a teen, we might also be talking to other people in that person's life, like parents and teachers. And if we're seeing symptoms of it, then that's a good indicator that that child or teen is suffering from anxiety. So it's really about reporting the symptoms and getting feedback, of course, from the teen as much as possible, but also the people who are around that teen and seeing what they notice.
Yeah, so if you are diagnosed by anxiety, then are there some strategies? I mean, they also give some medication as well, right?
Right. So typically when we're addressing symptoms of anxiety, there's two primary ways that we can treat it. We can treat it from the therapy and strategy development aspect, where we're looking at coping strategies, emotional regulation, having that teen really be aware of when those symptoms are creeping in so that they can use effective strategies. But also, often in tandem, medication is used. And so that is prescribed by an MD or a physician's assistant, and it's used to supplement the therapy strategies. So we know from research that when both of those treatments are used together is when we have the best outcome.
Oh, okay. And so, you know, I have, you know, friends who, you know, have anxiety, and like, what are some ways, like, if we were in school and my friends suddenly, you know, come across anxiety, like, what are some ways like I can help them?
Well, I think it's important, first of all, to recognize what the symptoms are. So when we think of anxiety, we think of you know, somebody who's experiencing like tense muscles or shortness of breath. Maybe they're getting sweaty. Maybe they're feeling like their fingers or toes are tingling. They might be reporting disrupted sleep or disrupted appetite. They might say that they have dizziness or feeling restless or like their chest is pounding. They might have increased urination, like, oh my gosh, I have to pee all the time when I get nervous. They might feel nauseous. And then there's emotional symptoms. They might second guess themselves. They might have a hard time making decisions. They might be prone to avoiding situations that might contribute to feelings of stress. A really common symptom is irritability. So if somebody's kind of always snapping at you, or they just seem to have like a short fuse, then that can be a really telltale symptom, especially in boys. I think girls are more likely to verbalize when they're feeling anxious, whereas boys, oftentimes we see that they look more angry and irritable. So these are people who get overwhelmed easily and they feel helpless, or they feel easily guilted, like, oh my goodness, I'm messing up or I'm failing at something. So if we recognize that in ourselves or our friends, and especially in the moment, right? So let's say you're with your friend, you're in the hallway, and they're like, oh my gosh, I feel so anxious right now. A lot of things you can do is just to be a good listener and say, you know, oh, thank you for telling me, you know, like, I'm right here, I'm here for you. Do you want to talk about it? Recognizing that you can validate their feelings versus, oh, you have nothing to be upset about. You're such a great student. This is not going to be hard. Versus, oh, I hear that you're frustrated, or I hear that you're worried. I know you're such a great student and you've worked really hard to study for this test. I do think it's going to be okay. But you're not being dismissive of what they're feeling, because that's a very difficult thing for people who struggle with anxiety, is when people are like, you shouldn't feel that way. So being present with your friend, giving them some reassurance that, you know, you believe in them and that you have confidence that they can be successful, reminding them to do something simple like take a deep breath or run their hands underwater, or develop something like some encouraging, truthful words they can say to themselves. So you might say, you know, you've got this. I want you to remind yourself, like, I studied hard, I'm prepared, I'm ready for this. And they can repeat that to themselves, whether they say it aloud or they just repeat it in their head. But you want them to replace some of those fretful feelings or negative feelings with something that is positive and truthful. You know, I tell people, you don't need to go into a test or into your baseball game and say, I'm going to be the best hitter ever and I'm going to get all the points at my baseball game. Like, that's not realistic. But to say, I've worked hard, I'm a good, solid baseball player, and I've got a great team, is a truthful, positive statement that is believable. And so making sure that people replace the negative thoughts in their brain with something that's positive and truthful can be a very helpful strategy in the moment.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. I'll keep that in mind. And I also see, like, if my, you know, some of my friends also have anxiety, just like Meka said. And so some students report having an anxiety attack. So do you want to share a little bit about what it is?
An anxiety attack is also called a panic attack. And if you're a person who has panic attacks frequently, so I think most people in their lives will experience a panic attack. But there's some people who their body defaults to getting into that panicky place pretty quickly. And it's that feeling of, you know, an overwhelming feeling of stress. Oftentimes it's accompanied with your heart beating fast, feeling sweaty, having a hard time catching your breath. A lot of people report that they feel like they're having a heart attack. So in the moment, that person is actually in a state of panic, and, you know, they'll say, you need to call 911, or I can't calm down, and they'll be sort of frantic. So some of the kids I work with will say, I had a panic attack and it lasted several hours. And in that situation, it's actually you're in a heightened state of anxiety for several hours. But a panic attack often is, you know, it might last a couple minutes, or, you know, under 10 minutes typically. And they're having that panicky feeling to the point where it would be difficult to do other things. Like, they would have a hard time taking an exam, or they certainly shouldn't be driving a car. And they might just be in a space where they need a lot of soothing. And so they oftentimes will step away from activities to deal with that panicky feeling. And one of the most worrisome or troublesome aspects of panic attacks is that once you have one, or once you have a couple, is you can really be bogged down with the fear that you're going to have another one. So there'll be teens, for example, who maybe they had a panic attack at school. And then they'll be so fearful they're going to have another one that they're like, I don't want to go to school, or I don't want to go to math class, or I don't want to be in front of this particular person, because they almost can develop like a superstition or a belief in fear that it can happen again. So I do encourage your listeners out there, if you've had a panic attack, like a real, you know, legitimate one, and you're getting preoccupied and having thoughts with having another one, definitely talk to an adult, talk to your parent, explain how you're feeling, because a therapist can really help you develop some strategies so you don't walk around with that fear, because it can make your world smaller if you're afraid to do things because you're like, oh my goodness, I'm going to embarrass myself and I'm going to get into that state of panicking and I'm not going to know what to do and I'm going to feel helpless and scared. And we want people to feel confident that even if you have a panic attack, like you're going to know what to do. So that's a form of anxiety that I think is important to sort of be aggressive in getting support for, if that's a characteristic you have when it comes to anxiety.
So as you said, panic attacks actually last a very short amount of time. So like, so what do you do like when you're having a panic attack? So what can you do?
Well, one of the first things I remind kids and teens is like, you're actually not dying. So you really need to remind yourself of that. Now, if I have a 40-year-old or a 50-year-old client who's having a panic attack, obviously there is more likelihood that there's a physical component like a heart attack. So it's harder with adults to really reassure them that they're not going to die. But with kids, we can be pretty sure it's not some sort of cardiac event. So it's, once again, it's reminding them and having them be able to remind themselves, like, I am going to get through this. I am going to be okay. Making sure that they're taking appropriate breaths. So that means, you know, breathing in through your nose and out through your mouth. So I'll tell kids, smell the birthday cake and then blow out the candle. Because when you breathe in through your nose, it triggers a certain part of your brain to calm down. So versus just breathing in and out through your mouth, you kind of can just get to a state where you're sort of just panting like a dog and you can actually increase your distress. So making sure that they are breathing appropriately, that they're actively reminding themselves that they are not going to die, they are safe, and they're going to get through this. Replacing those panicky thoughts with something that's more relaxing. So, you know, having them think through the process of, okay, when I'm done with this exam, I'm going to go and get in my car and we're going to go get an ice cream cone. And the rest of the day, I'm going to be able to watch my favorite show, and really getting into a place mentally where they're imagining themselves in a calmer place. And it's really having them just get through that momentary crisis. And so you're not, you know, solving the anxiety problem in that moment, but you're just having them get through the crisis. Some people find it reassuring to have their hand held or their back rubbed. A lot of times people can do well with just having another physical thing to focus on. So for example, it can be one of the things I think is really effective is running an ice cube over your wrist, because having an ice cube against your skin is a little bit uncomfortable, and it's not about causing discomfort or pain, but it's about having that focus in your body go from your thoughts or your sweatiness or your breathing, your disrupted breathing, to just something else. You know, sometimes taking someone's hand and gently squeezing the tips of their fingers, just to have that pressure, having somebody take off their shoes and run their feet through the grass or feel their feet on a cool concrete. Like, it's just something else that focuses their mind and their body to some other sensation. Sometimes people will say, okay, well, think of your five senses. I want you to look around and look at for five things you can see and name them, you know, two things that you can smell and name them, you know, four things that you can touch and name them. And you just kind of go through some sort of ritual that is comforting and stabilizing. And so those are things we want people to do in the moment when they're having a panic attack.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, you know, true, because I think for listeners out there, like you said, Dr. Tara, if you are having an anxiety attack, like, you should definitely ask for help and not like suffer it alone, because, you know, it is serious as well. So moving on, what are some differences? I think a lot of people confuse anxiety and depression. So what are some differences between the two?
So the fact that people confuse them is actually really understandable, because there are some overlapping symptoms. I mentioned irritability and trouble concentrating, disrupted sleep, sometimes weight gain or weight loss. Those are things that we can see with both of those conditions. But the difference between anxiety and depression is oftentimes with depression, people feel overwhelmed with sadness. They may be more likely to cry. They can have really negative thinking. They can feel either very restless, like sort of jittery, or they can feel like they have very low energy and are quick to feel fatigue. Sometimes they're suicidal thoughts, not always though. So occasionally I have teens say, well, I can't be depressed because I don't want to kill myself. And you don't need to want to kill yourself to have it be depression. But if you're just feeling weighted down and you're having a hard time enjoying pleasurable things, sometimes we think of depression as like, okay, I feel more sad about sad things. And that's true. But also one of the most disrupted parts of depression is having a loss of interest in pleasurable things. So that's really like sad and frustrating for somebody who has depression is it's like, well, I used to be so happy when I rode my horse or when I spent time with my boyfriend or girlfriend, or I used to feel so proud of myself when I did well on an exam. And I'm just having a hard time getting into that space of contentness or happiness. Like that's a pretty strong sign of depression.
And also, like, can you like self-diagnose depression, like get tested like on the online? Because like, and I've seen like people saying like, oh, you know, I have depression. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, okay, like, I think you should go see a doctor instead of, you know, looking online through these tests and stuff like that. So can you self-diagnose yourself?
Well, I think that there's a lot of teens out there who have some good general information about depression, and they're recognizing in themselves a change. They recognize their sleep is disrupted, or they feel really fatigued, or they're having a hard time feeling pleasure over pleasurable things. And with that insight, they need to go to a professional and make sure that it's also not something else. Like, what if your thyroid is messed up, or, you know, you have some sort of, you know, nutritional deficiency? Maybe it is anxiety and not depression. Like, we do want to make sure that even if you're having symptoms of depression, that you can recognize that you're being treated for it appropriately. We would never want to just take a low, I'm trying to think of what the word I want to say. We don't want to have a passive approach to depression and just think of it as like, this is who I am and this is part of my life. Like, I want people to understand that with therapy, with medicine, like, you don't have to live that way. So if you feel like you have depression, chances are you've got some good insight there, but it's important to do the next step, which is to get support for it and making sure you're collaborating with the adults in your life who love you and are able to get you access to these people, like medical professionals and therapists or the school counselor, but to not look at it as like, this is just who I am and I'm just going to be miserable, because it just doesn't have to be that way.
There are like medication and treatments you can get for depression. What are some like natural ways that you can help yourself?
Well, if medicine doesn't seem like a good fit for you, and that's fine, it's got to be a decision that you make in collaboration with your parents and your medical professionals. But there's some things that you can do to alleviate symptoms of depression. One of the primary things you can do is to get enough sleep. And I know the last time we spoke, we talked about how important that is and how that's such a challenge for teens. Teens, you know, they want to stay up later. Like, that's part of your circadian rhythm. You know, going to bed at 10 p.m. might feel excessively early for you. You might be really busy with a sports team or your academic pursuits. And so it can feel like you just don't have time to sleep as much as your body needs. So that's one thing, to make sure you're getting enough sleep. Another thing is to make sure that you are being mindful about your media content. So if you are looking at, for example, your Instagram, and everybody who's posting on Instagram is talking about the amazing things that are in their life, the colleges they got into, their pictures of them, adorable pictures of themselves with their significant other, that great vacation they went on over summer with their family, and you're looking at your own life and are having a hard time getting into a space of feeling grateful for the things you have, or maybe you have some things that are just super overwhelming and, you know, you're just not in a place to be grateful, but, or you're looking at a lot of images that show an impossible standard of beauty and it just causes you to feel worthless or down about yourself. Like, you can really exacerbate symptoms of depression just based on what you are inundating yourself as far as, you know, what content. If you're watching a lot of really gloomy TV shows that show violence or despairing characters, if you are reading novels where there isn't, you know, a silver lining in the story, like, there's all sorts of things that we do in our general life that impact our mood. A lack of exercise is a real issue for teens these days, especially considering how attached we are to our computers. It's hard to set down our cell phones and our schoolwork and go and either be in nature or move your body and not feel like, oh my goodness, I should be doing something different, or I'm out of shape, so this doesn't feel fun to me. But sleep, exercise, managing social media content, and then making sure that you're surrounding yourself with people who are kind to you and that you have healthy relationships with. Sometimes when we feel down about ourselves and we don't feel that we're like deserving, we won't set a boundary with a partner to say, please don't treat me that way. Or say something to a friend of like, hey, you really hurt my feelings. Or speak up to a parent about what it is that you need. And so we can just end up surrounding ourselves with people and content that isn't really helping us on our journey to get healthier. And that takes a lot of mindfulness from that person, because misery loves company. And sometimes if we're feeling down or we're struggling with mental illness, we'll be attracted to other people who are also in that space. And then we kind of ruminate together. And it's really hard to get into a path where you're headed more towards health.
Yeah, so I was going to say that I totally relate to what you said, Dr. Tara, because sometimes when I look on Instagram, it's like, even because of the pandemic, it's like I'm really busy with like college apps and, you know, other extracurriculars. So like I can totally relate to what you said, because sometimes when I look at Instagram, like so many people went to Hawaii, a lot of people went to Florida, and it makes me jealous. Like, what? Like, how are these people like during the pandemic? And we are like taking precautions because still, you know, this COVID is still out there. It hasn't totally disappeared yet. So I totally relate to what you said, because sometimes I just get, I'm just so sad, like I'm not going anywhere and things like that. So I totally relate to what you said.
Well, and with COVID, you can get into a space where you feel sort of cheated, because you honestly, these kids have been cheated. You know, there's a lot of people who weren't able to participate in their junior year, their senior year, a prom. They couldn't get an after school job. Some of their sports activities were canceled, or there's certain friendships that you really couldn't explore. I mean, there's some kids who are like, I can't even go on like a date or go to any parties. And it makes sense that you'd have an emotional reaction to that. I think adults are having a lot of impact on that too, as far as, you know, when your kids are home all day and you're like, gosh, am I failing as a parent? Or am I able to balance work and home life? For me, staring at myself on Zoom all day and being aware of like every little laugh line. I mean, I have bought so much makeup in the last year, and my eye makeup game is so much stronger because I had to stare at myself all day. And like, do I have low self-esteem over it? I don't. But imagine if I had body image issues, or I wasn't comfortable with aging. I mean, that could be a huge stressor on me. So for me, you know, Amazon packages with cool, you know, eyeshadow came into my front door, and it's fine. But for some people, there's been a much bigger impact. So that's a very like legitimate thing to point out to your audience, is the impact of COVID on our well-being, on our coping strategies, on our feelings of like feeling things are unfair.
Yeah, like school is also definitely hard during this pandemic. I think like when we passed, like when junior year was over, I feel so really, I was like, oh, finally school is over. Because for me too, like on Zoom, I have to like look good. And so you have to like most classes, in at least in my year, most of my teachers were like, oh, you need to turn on your video and I need to see what you're doing, if you're paying attention. So like sometimes I always look at myself all the time. I don't know if it's like a psychological thing. I just have to look at myself. Like I don't look at the teacher. But if I'm answering, I'm like looking at myself. And the teacher thinks I'm doing something else, even though I am paying attention. So yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, in regular life, we kind of only look at ourselves in the morning or when we, you know, stop at the bathroom. And so now we're doing it all day long. So it makes sense. And I think it's important for people to kind of give themselves some grace over that and recognize like what your experience right now is kind of not real, you know?
Yeah, I do the same thing as Marcia said. I feel like I get scared, like Zoom, like I know like when I get called and I turn on my microphone, my box will be in front of everyone else's, you know, a camera. So it gets me really scared. I'm just like, it's okay, it's okay. I have to like, you know, calm myself down. It's okay. You know, it's just on camera. Cause I feel like, you know, during school, not everyone will be looking at you when you, you know, answer a question. So yeah, this was definitely more difficult for me, but like, you know, we had to do it.
Well, and think about the kids who have parents fighting in the background. Or there's, you know, something just embarrassing going on where there, you know, there's, I don't know, just a background that has something that causes self-consciousness. So, I mean, you and I were able to just like be like, oh, does my eye makeup look good or is my hair sticking up? But then there's families where, you know, mom and dad are screaming at each other in the background, or, you know, mom's holding, you know, an alcoholic drink and she's got her bathrobe on and she walked by the back of the you know, camera, and the kids are just like, oh, my goodness. Like, there's parts of their life that have been revealed through this process that make people really uncomfortable. And I know as a parent who sometimes works from home, you know, I'm pretty aware of like whose camera's on at what time and am I interrupting, and it, you know, did the dog go running into the room and, you know, goes and licks their face and they're trying to talk about something to their history teacher. But I mean, for some families, like, they just don't have the ability to just be a student.
Yeah, so moving on, we wanted to talk more about ADHD, and ADHD is one of the most common mental health disorders affecting children, and ADHD also affects many adults. So how does ADHD impact executive functioning and overall mental health?
So ADHD stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, and it is like a neurobiological condition. So we do see that when we look at like brain scans and things like that, that there's differences between a person who has ADHD, you know, their brain, and somebody who doesn't. So there's three primary symptoms we tend to see. We tend to see inattention, so that distractibility, hard time focusing, can't remain sustained attention. We also see hyperactivity. Not everybody has the hyperactivity piece, but that's when you're restless, have a hard time sitting still, very fidgety. You know, these kids are often just have a lot of body movements, and people can find them a little frustrating because they're always bouncing in their seat or touching stuff or tapping. And then there's the impulsivity piece where, you know, words come out of their mouth really impulsively, or they react, their body reacts in a way without stopping to think. So for people or kids with ADHD, everything's kind of a little harder, you know? They kind of have this extra step that their brain has to go through to sort of stop, stay focused, or stop, you know, and pull back on some of that restlessness and overactivity and impulsivity to be able to go about their day. So, you know, in how we treat ADHD is similar to anxiety or depression, where we have a combination of therapy as well as there can be medication usage. And so for kids with ADHD, school can be a little bit more stressful, social interactions can be a little bit more stressful, and it's something that is, if we understand this about a kid, if we understand the impact it has on a kid or a teen, we can do a lot to support them. But it is a tougher thing if you have that diagnosis to be able to go through and be effective in all the areas of your life.
Oh yeah, so moving on, we want to talk about divorce. And you know, since the, you know, during the pandemic, most of the families had a lot of trouble staying at home for several months. And that was a time where a lot of sexual abuse increased, divorce rates increased, they like skyrocketed. I was like reading one of the articles, and you know, when I was reading that, it was like really sad because, you know, not many people, like women especially, weren't safe at that time. So how does divorce impact kids, and how can they cope with it?
Yeah, divorce is really tough on kids. I mean, we know that families right now are going through a lot of stress with COVID. You know, there's been some job insecurity. You know, coping strategies have been really stretched to the limit. Kids are around all the time and they're not, kids are around all the time and they're not having the same activities and things to sort of keep them on a schedule. So there are some incidents of kids, you know, struggling with behavior and parents struggling to use their coping skills when it comes to managing family time. So I've definitely seen an increase in my caseload of families going through separation and divorce. And that's one of my specialty areas, is I do a lot of work with families who are going through separation and divorce, and we're trying to help the kids adjust to the best of their ability, as well as help the parents co-parent in an effective way. So one of the main things that I would love your listeners who are, you know, kids and teens out there, and even parents, to recognize is it's not the kid's responsibility to manage the divorce. You know, we don't want kids to be put in a position where they feel like they have to help their parents minimize conflict. We don't want them to be focused on adult problems, right? Like finances or managing that adult's emotions, if the adult's feeling lonely or scared or overwhelmed. Like, we don't want the burden of that to fall on the child. We want kids to be able to maintain their routine as much as possible. So if possible, to go to the same school, to be able to participate in the same activities that they've enjoyed, to have access to their friend group. We want parents to uphold the same standards of behaviors that they always have in the past. So when parents go through a divorce, there's oftentimes a lot of guilt that they feel that their kids are being put in this situation, and it's uncomfortable and it's stressful. But what we don't want to do is lower our standards for our kids where they are permitted to develop bad habits. And that might mean hanging out with kids who aren't a good influence, blowing off schoolwork, you know, not managing their sleep schedule or their technology schedule. Like, we want to still have those standards for our kids because it provides stability. And then it also sets them up for success later on. We want kids to see that there can be conflicts with other people, but we can get to a point where there's conflict resolution. So it's okay for parents to argue with each other. It doesn't need to be violent. We don't want it to be all the time. But if parents are like, hey, your dad and I are having a disagreement over whether or not you're going to do that soccer camp this summer, like, we're going to need some time to work it out. And then kids can see that their parents eventually come to a conclusion about it, even if one parent's kind of unhappy with the conclusion. That's a great lesson for kids to see, like, all right, we can manage this even if it's hard. So, and with kids, get support, whether you need to work with a counselor, whether you surround yourself with people who are good listeners and good distractors, right? Sometimes it's fun to go to the mall with a friend and look at fun clothes and stop and get a coffee, and it doesn't need to be focused on the things at home that are really tough. Other times we want to have an opportunity to talk with a friend about what's stressful or what's bothersome, and it's okay to grieve. Because going through divorce for everybody involved, parents, kids, extended family members, is a process of grief because there is a sense of loss. So we want kids to be able to honor that feeling and process that grief, but still have the opportunity to have a fulfilling life where they get to be a kid.
Divorce can be really hard on, like, especially younger children, right? You know, I read, like, yeah, younger kids especially can have, you know, a lot of changes in behavior, other problems, and also maybe like health problems or something like that.
Well, I can't say that in my experience of working with parents and families who are going through separation or divorce, that it necessarily has a greater impact on younger versus older kids. Some of it depends on the kid, depends on their personality, how resilient they are, how well do they handle change generally, how disrupted their life is. And so with younger kids, sometimes if they were shielded from a lot of the conflict and they didn't experience a whole childhood of watching their parents fight and disagree, sometimes those kids can end up having better adjustment because their parents get to a space where they're healthier and they didn't drag these little kids into their adult problems. Whereas sometimes with teenagers, they might have a long history of there being conflict with their parents. The parents, let's say they have a 15-year-old, they might think it's more appropriate to tell that 15-year-old about some of the adult components. And so then this teenager, who shouldn't have to deal with these things, suddenly does have to. And they might have an impression of relationships that is negative or unhealthy because they've lived an entire lifetime with parents who maybe had significant struggles in their marriage. So it really depends. I mean, if parents can unite and stay focused on the kids, get them the mental health support that they need, maintain their routine, show them appropriate conflict resolution, there's a lot of indication that these kids are going to be fine and come out well adjusted. Yesterday I had a parent I was working with, and it was with a small boy, you know, a young preschool age child. And the dad said something like, well, of course he's going to be messed up over this. And I was like, no, I don't want you to have the impression that it's a foregone conclusion that you're going to have a poorly adjusted child simply because mom and dad went through a divorce. And this was a family who had so many strengths. The mom and dad were able to collaborate generally well. They had some financial resources to make sure their child had access to great daycare, wonderful schools, appropriate health care. You know, they were working with me and they were both in agreement about that. And the child had some nice friends and they had some supportive family members. Like, there was a lot of protective factors for this child that was going to bode well for him growing up to have a very healthy childhood, even though his parents were divorced. There's other times where divorce is hugely disruptive. You know, the communication with the parents is toxic. There's a huge financial disruption, or kids are pulled away from one of the parents or their friends and routine. In that situation, that's going to be a completely different story for those kids because they're put under a lot more stress.
Yeah, definitely. I have a friend, and I think a few years ago, we were in PE class, and so it was like break time, and so she was telling me like how her parents split up and stuff, and you know, she was still keeping a positive mindset. So I definitely knew, I can't imagine like, you know, my parents or anything like that. You know, it's definitely really hard. And I feel like, you know, for teens especially, it's like now it's becoming common too in the pandemic, you know, since it recently hit, like mom and dad are usually, you know, are involved in more arguments because they're just stuck at home. You're not going anywhere. So what should teens keep in mind, like, once they know? Because I know some teens, they just start crying and are like, get so upset. They don't have any support system, or they might not have that many friends that they can talk to. So what should they keep in mind?
Yeah, they feel helpless too, that they can't do anything to, you know, help their parents stop fighting.
Yeah, I think that that's really difficult when they're watching their parents fight. Because if parents are having an argument, it is appropriate for the kid to step away. I mean, they shouldn't jump in and defend a parent. Obviously, if there's any kind of physical component or there's any kind of safety concerns, kids should absolutely call the police if it gets to that extreme. But if it's just parents arguing, I would rather that kids step away, that they go to their room, they shut the door, they turn on some favorite music, that they understand they actually don't have a lot of control in that moment, especially while the fighting is going on. Now, later on, after things have calmed down, if you approach one of the parents and say, you know, this made me so sad, like I was so upset, I felt helpless and I felt scared. You know, sometimes when parents have an awareness of the impact on the kids, they will at minimum save the arguing for another time. And sometimes parents, when they're arguing, they think the kids don't know or they think the kids can't hear them. And so sometimes bringing it to the parents' attention is enough to help those parents make better choices, especially if the child can be honest and say, this is how it impacted me. I couldn't sleep last night. I was crying. I called this friend and we were on the phone. We were on FaceTime and we could hear you arguing and it was embarrassing. You know, I hate the way you talk to mom when you argue, or I hate the things you're saying to dad, and I don't want to be part of it. That one of the scariest things for kids during divorce is how helpless they feel, because it's not up to them. They're not responsible for their parents' feelings. They can't do anything to make their parents have a healthier relationship. I have had kids tell their parents, like, go to counseling, like, do something, like, even get divorced. You know, if you're in a family where there's a lot of conflict between parents, a lot of times kids can feel a sense of relief when the divorce happens because they're out of the conflict. Other times, one of the most stressful times for kids during divorce is if the parents have hid their conflict, kids think everything is fine, and all of a sudden they come home from school one day and parents are like, oh, we're separating, and the kid's like, wait, what? So it's, you know, that's actually more stressful for kids than when kids see openly that a marriage is unhappy and unhealthy and parents split. So, I mean, I don't want to tell parents like, oh, if you're having a terrible marriage, like, let your kids know. But at the same time, recognize all the hiding you have done. And by making these kids think you have a normal, healthy marriage is not necessarily going to make the situation better. Like, there's probably going to have to be a lot more discussions about, hey, we did hide this from you. Like, we, mom and dad really wanted you to stay out of this as an adult problem. But here's some things. We've been struggling to get along. You know, we have a difference in parenting styles or whatever it is. You know, something kid-friendly. It doesn't need to be, you know, adult-oriented. But I think in those situations, it's going to be more of a mystery to kids on why their parents are getting divorced. And they're going to have a lot more questions and confusion.
Yeah, definitely. I also feel like some parents are like really aware. Sometimes they're like, you know, if they're having an argument, they're like, oh no, don't say anything right now, just stop, because you know the kids must be, you know, the kids must be hearing, so we probably should stop because they shouldn't hear what we're talking about. So I definitely, that's definitely true.
In an ideal world, in a healthy marriage, kids would see some conflict sometimes and see the resolution. So it's when we have conflict and somebody storms out of the house or somebody says hateful things and the kids never see, well, how do we resolve it? Whereas if they see one parent apologize or the parents hug or kiss and say, you know, I'm sorry, and they move on, that's a healthy way to show conflict. Because it's not that healthy marriages or healthy relationships don't have conflict. It's that they can learn to deal with it in a healthy way. So sometimes kids will say to me, you know, like, they can't be my friend. Like, we're talking about little kids. And they'll be like, because we argue or we got into a fight. And I'm like, we actually argue just as much with our friends as we do with our non-friends. But the difference is we have good conflict resolution with our friends. The people who we're not friends with, oftentimes we can't get to a resolution. So conflict resolution is a super important thing for parents to role model for their kids. But if parents don't have a healthy way of doing that, then oftentimes it's helpful for them to get the counseling support so they can learn that skill and then role model it in a healthy way for their kids.
Yeah, definitely. Before ending this episode, we wanted to talk about more about your journey. And, you know, you have a doctorate in psychology as well. So we wanted to understand what made you so interested in psychology.
So one of the reasons that I'm so interested in psychology is because I grew up with a parent who was very mentally ill. So my mother had, you know, really major depression. She really struggled with coping skills. Easily overwhelmed, very anxious, very moody. She struggled to connect to other people. As we got older, she struggled more and more with it. And it just made me recognize, like, there's so much support that parents need out there, because I do work a lot with parents. And then there's the support that their kids need. And I think in my mother's situation, had she received appropriate mental health care at a younger age, she may have had a completely different life. And so I know that that is what's driven my interest in the field of mental health. I originally went to college and got a degree in education and psychology, and then I moved into school psychology, and that's what my doctorate is in. So I worked in public schools for a long time supporting kids who were struggling in school with their achievement, with behavior, with their social skills. And then about 10 years ago, I opened up a private practice here in Charlotte, North Carolina, called Charlotte Parent Coaching. And that was me primarily working with parents and their kids. And the reason why parents call me up is, one, if they need support when dealing with a separation or divorce, or if their kids are really struggling with behavior. So these are kids who have tantrums, they're maybe disrespectful to their parents, maybe they're having a lot of difficulty with friendship, maybe they have aggression, like their temper tantrums cause hitting or kicking or pinching. Some of these kids will have imbalance when it comes to technology usage. So basically any kid of any age, when parents are feeling like, I don't know what to do, like, I don't know how to parent this kid, I don't know what to do to have them be healthier, then they call me up. And in the last couple of years, you know, I've expanded my business to have the podcast. I have a podcast called One Day You'll Thank Me, and I co-host it with my teenage daughter, and she's 16. And so we have a series of episodes that are solo episodes where we pick a topic and we talk about it. But I also do a lot of guest interviews with experts, and we talk about things like eating disorders and porn addiction and depression and anxiety and all sorts of things. Like, and it's just really important to me that not only do I provide good clinical care to the people that I work with individually, but I also provide resources that anybody can access. So the resources that I have that anyone can access are best found on my website, and it's www.drtaraegan.com. And at that website, you can find all the podcasts that I've done. You can get see the books that I've written. My next book is going to be launched in August, and it's for first-time toddler moms to talk about how they can support their toddlers as they grow and manage their behavior. I offer some free resources if somebody's interested in having me do a public speaking event. Like, that's the place to go to find out more about my work. I've recently started a YouTube channel, and I just do that by myself. I don't include my daughter in that, but there's a lot of information in there about ADHD, divorce and separation, anxiety. So that it's really important to me that I provide resources for everyone. And it's just over the years, you know, now I have teenagers of my own, And I'm so much more experienced as a clinician. And I've seen some of my clients grow up in homes where parents are really struggling. And there's just so much that can be done to support them. And so I just want to be part of that.
Yeah, so make sure to check our podcast. I'll link the description.
Yeah, psychology is actually really interesting. Varsha actually took AP psychology, and I'm doing a psychology course right now during the summer. So yeah, it's very interesting. Do you have any advice for students who want to, you know, major in psychology?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that is most helpful is to get experience working with different kinds of people. You know, oftentimes we interact with people who are just like us and have the same value system, the same educational background. And in the process of whether you become a psychologist or an educator or you're a professor or you're working in a collaborative work environment, like understanding how to communicate with people and how to sort of honor who they are and their background and not just assume everybody's going to be able to work it out like you do is really helpful. So it might be that you have a job where you're providing customer service towards someone, or you're working with children. I know one of the things that was very influential for me was I had a job in college where I worked in a group home. So it was individuals who had cognitive disabilities as well as a dual diagnosis of mental health issues. And these are individuals who couldn't live on their own. You know, their impairments caused them to need, you know, supervision. And so I worked in a group home and I helped these individuals, you know, reach their goals and go through their daily functioning. And I got to know them so well on such a personal level. And it really sparked my interest in working with kids with disabilities. Had I not had that job, I don't know. I don't know what if my career path would have been the same. So you want to make sure that you're providing yourself the opportunity to work with different people. I know for me, like my compassionate self is really drawn to parents and kids. I have some colleagues who are very inspired by individuals who are struggling with drug addiction or trauma survivors. And so knowing sort of who you have the most compassion for is really helpful, because as a psychologist, you can get pretty burned out. You know, as a therapist, when you hear, you know, some of the hard parts of people's lives and you're constantly in a state of like working to help them, if you're not feeling really called to that, it can be pretty exhausting. So I do a lot of work with like DSS, you know, if you have to call Child Protective Services, if there's a child being abused. And those are difficult weeks, or kids who are suicidal, you know, like they're never far from your mind. You're always kind of thinking, is there something I should be doing differently? You do have to do a lot of research and constantly getting support from colleagues who might have a different perspective or more expertise. So it's a kind of a process of being a lifelong learner, which really interests me. Like, I don't have any days that look the same. Like, every day has a lot of variety in both the people I interact with, the type of work I do. I might be, like today, on a podcast, or I might be writing a book, or I might be doing public speaking, or I might be seeing 8 clients that day, or I could be in a school observing, or I could go into a home and help parents navigate, you know, temper tantrums. Every day is so different for me, and I love that. I mean, that is a huge motivator and you know, provides a lot of sense of fulfillment. But for other people, that might seem scary or unpredictable.
Yeah, I took AP psychology junior year, and I'm really glad because, you know, the classes were from, I mean, in California, I think most schools were doing distance learning, and I think they're out of state, I think. So we have in our podcast community, there were a lot of kids who are like, oh, students like teens, just like us juniors. They were like, oh, we're doing hybrid learning. But for us, it was just, you know, most California was, you know, distance learning because they don't want to take the risk. And since COVID was really, the rates were really high here. I mean, now it has leveled down because everyone's got the vaccine. But yeah, so I was just going back to my point. So it was really interesting in AP psych because I took AP psychology. It was really interesting. There was like so many stuff that I didn't know about, and I really wanted to figure out like, oh, like why does this, does how many, you know, what are the disorders? Like, I didn't think in this episode we talked about like ADHD, depression. It was really interesting to understand. And I think, you know, because of the pandemic, a lot of people, you know, are struggling with their mental health severely. Like, I think a lot, I saw a lot of suicides among teenagers especially. And so I think, like, one of my friends were saying, maybe, you know, maybe I should major in psychology because I want to help, you know, kids, or like teens especially, or, you know, even older people, because they also struggle with their mental health too. It's not just teens. So I think it's going to be like a booming career as well, like at this time.
Well, I think that most of us, as far as my colleagues and I, would agree that COVID has not impacted our business or our field. And in fact, you know, we have more clients than ever because it is such a needy time. So it's there's never gonna your job security is pretty high. Now, I own a private practice, so I have to not just think about the clinical care that I provide, but I'm running a business. So I have to think about, you know, the services I offer and the customer service and keeping track of records and making sure that I am promoting myself, like marketing myself and things like that. So it's not just about having really good training as a clinician. You have to think about the business side of it too. Other time, like when I was a school psychologist working in schools, I didn't have to think about that at all. All my clients were just lined up in the hallway. So, you know, there's different components. You know, there's a lot of psychologists out there who, or mental health clinicians who teach at the college level, or they do research and they're really doing some, you know, fantastic work in like the foundations of understanding human development. So there's a lot of opportunities. It is important to realize that if you're thinking of majoring in psychology or a related mental health field, whether it's counseling or social work, sports psychology, whatever it is, it's really important to understand that you're going to need to get a graduate degree. So, students who graduate with a psychology degree, that's actually a really general degree, and it's going to be hard for you to get something specific in that field, especially something that's paid in, you know, to the degree that you can actually have a functional life. If you have the master's or the doctorate, and you have the ability to work in multiple settings, you're licensed, you have malpractice insurance, then it's a complete game changer as far as your ability to support yourself and your family.
Yeah, I think it's really important. Also, you should be passionate about it, as you said. Like, find something that passionate you're really passionate about. If it's psychology, then, you know, study hard, and it'll be a really good reward. To wrap this up, we actually have a question from our listeners, and it's related to Pride Month. And they asked, how do you console people in the LGBTQ community who are trying to get their family to accept them but having a hard time?
So, since I work with kids and I work with families, of course, that means that I work with kids who have, you know, all sorts of diversity, including gender diversity, you know. And it's important for people to realize out there that if there is a subset of mental health clinicians who specialize in this. And so it's important, like, I'm not one of those clinicians who specialize in it. So I want to have your audience understand that there's people who have highly or who are highly trained in this area. This is the primary population they work with. They really can understand the relationship between acceptance and like the cultural background or religious background, things like that. And all of that needs to be intertwined when it comes to providing high quality care for these individuals. So first of all, that's the first thing I want to say is make sure that if you're looking for a clinician, that you do some searching and make sure not only do you want to find a clinician who is LGBTQ affirming, but you also want to have somebody who has additional training on how to support these individuals because it's really essential that they receive the support, the acknowledgement, the validation, that they understand what their rights are, how to advocate for themselves, you know, when they need to be good communicators about their needs and when they might need to step away from a relationship because it's toxic or unhealthy or too close-minded. So working with a professional who has that knowledge base is going to be essential because we do know that these individuals have a higher risk of having suicidal ideation as well as completed suicides. So it's something that, you know, we want to make sure to support these kids and these teens in a really meaningful way so that they can set themselves up to live a life that feels authentic to them.
Yeah, I actually have one more question. So, what can you do, if a kid or a child, like, you're going through something, but, like, you know, the parents don't believe in counseling or don't believe in that type of thing? Because what can you do? Like, if you're, yeah, what can you do?
So one thing is you always have your school counselor as a resource. So you can go down and talk to the school counselor, and there are some resources that you can access without parental permission. So I had a friend in high school whose parents were alcoholics, and they had a group program right at school that was designed for kids who had parents who were misusing substances. And she did it, you know, for years, every week. And it really helped support her through that time. And then when she got old enough and she went to college, she accessed the counseling services on the college campus. But it wasn't something she felt comfortable saying to her parents, like, I need help because you guys are drinking too much and it scares me. So there are some resources, and there's rights that kids have as far as confidentiality. And so it's really important that they let the adults in their life know if they're struggling with something. So, and there's free hotlines, you know, like the National Suicide Hotline. There's books and sort of self-help resources online that kids can access. Like, it, unfortunately, it requires them to be their own best advocate if they don't feel like their parents are going to be receptive to them receiving mental health care. Another thing I just want to say is there are times when parents, or when kids, make the assumption that their parents would never go for it. But when a kid goes to them and says, I'm struggling, I need somebody to talk to, that parents will say, oh, okay, I just didn't know, you know, like, and they'll be open-minded to it. But kids will wait. They'll hope that their parents notice that they're struggling and will offer that. But sometimes it's just got to be something that kids ask for. But if they really feel like their parents aren't going to go for it, or they have asked their parents and their parents have said, no, you don't need that, that's only for kids who are crazy, or, you know, our family doesn't do that, we don't tell people our problems, then probably the best resource is going to be the school counselor.
Yeah, that's good advice. Yeah, I think that's it. Do you have anything that you wanted to talk about?
I think this has been an excellent interview. I think you covered a lot of subjects. Mm-hmm. And if your listeners have questions, you know, they're very welcome to reach out to me. Like I said, they can go to www.drtaraegan.com, and there is a place that they can fill out a contact form if they have a question. And I'll always do my best to help. And if you feel like your parents are struggling, or your parents would benefit from getting support, whether it's with their parenting or co-parenting with, mm-hmm. you know, their ex-spouse, mm-hmm. or they're struggling with their own mental illness, you know, please refer them to my website also, because even if it's not the type of support that I give, yeah. I'm going to do my best to find them somebody who can be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for sure we'll link that down below. So yeah. Are there like online sessions?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I provide therapy services to residents of North Carolina. That's what my therapy uh-huh. licensure allows. I do also offer parent coaching services and more of a national level. Mm-hmm. Now, parent coaching is not the same as therapy. And it's really mm-hmm. focused on the here and now. It's very strategy focused. You know, we're not talking about like the pains of your childhood and trying to manage trauma and things like that. But my parent coaching clients, what we're working on is like, what do I do here and now when my kids are struggling with something? Mm-hmm. And so that's a resource. And I screen parents very carefully to make sure that that's an appropriate service. If I feel mm-hmm. like there's a mental health component that is not appropriate for counseling, or I'm sorry, for coaching, then I do what I can to help find them a clinician in their state that can provide them with the counseling services that they need. But, and then I also offer some online resources, you know, that there's like online courses and things like that, mm-hmm. that parents can access. There's some free downloadable resources that mm-hmm. they can access. They can access the YouTube channel or the podcast. So I try to give a variety of resources, but yes, there is the opportunity to work one-on-one with me in a parent coaching format if it's outside of North Carolina.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so thank you so much, Dr. Tara, for joining. I had a really fun time. I learned so much from, you know, I learned so much from you. And yeah, maybe, you know, we can bring you again in the third, maybe in another episode.
Absolutely. I appreciate you guys having me. It's really great. And I love your podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was really fun. Like, I loved talking to you. It's probably, you know, one of my favorite episodes too. Just talking to you, learn more about, you know, mental health. And it was really interesting for me.
Look good. Thank you so much.
Have a great day, everyone. It's me, Varsha.
And Mega.
signing off.